moment, but maybe we'll wait and see. But I think it's a little bit far to think of it as something possible now. But generally speaking, there will be, yes, a kind of a confrontation coming soon.
This brings about a very important notion. Dr. Nimr, a very important notion that brings about to the Palestinian scene is a shift in the balance of power, in the power of initiative, which is benefiting the Palestinian natives against the Zionist occupation. But in all of this scene, in 1 minute, do you think that the Oslo Agreement is still viable, it's still a reality inside of Palestine?
It depends on who's looking at it. From our point of view as people, Palestinian people in general, and the Palestinian resistance, definitely Oslo became the two-state solution is two-state illusion, and Oslo is dead. That's it. No more thinking even of it or going back to it in any way. Maybe the Palestinian Authority is backed by the Europeans, the Americans. They are still talking about, you know, two-state solution and Oslo agreement in a way or another, because they have no other alternative to that. If the European, for instance, said that the two-state solution failed, so what's next? What's the next step? What is the alternative? They have no alternative, and they don't want to think about, you know, one state or the idea that this colonial project called Israel, as a colonial racist apartheid regime, should be confronted not only by the Palestinians, but also by all the Arab, Islamic, as well as the international community.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Saad Nimr, academic at Birzeit University, talking to us about the shift of power inside of Palestine towards the Palestinian natives. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the developments inside of Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, parallel to the Omani delegation continuing its talks in Sana'a for the second week in a row, there were persistent American attempts to push towards the legalization of the presence of foreign forces in Yemeni lands and waters, and to even postpone talking about this presence indefinitely. This new condition angered Sana'a and embarrassed the Omanis. The efforts of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia to limit the talks to what falls under Ansarullah's control completely contradicts the principles of the resistance movement, which considers that engaging in any international endeavors that surpasses Yemeni independence is an illegal matter and unacceptable to be placed under negotiations. More in this following report.
As he prepared for departure from Sana'a with a delegation of the office of the Sultan of Oman on Friday, the spokesman of the Yemeni Ansarullah movement and the head of its negotiation delegation, Muhammad Abdus Salam, announced that the Omanis have been presented with the possible vision for ending the aggression and lifting the siege imposed on Yemen, beginning with securing the humanitarian operation. Abdus Salam pointed out that the meetings of the Omani delegation included the leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, head of the Supreme Political Council, the General Staff, the Coordination and Redeployment Committee in Hodeidah, and social and political figures from Ma'rib Governorate. Meanwhile, the Omani Foreign Minister, Badr al-Busaidi, arrived on Thursday in the Saudi capital, Riyadh, bearing a written message from Sultan Haytham bin Tariq to King Salman. The message appears to be related to the discussions held by the Omani royal delegation in Sana'a over a period of 5 days, whose indications suggested that a significant breakthrough has been achieved in the humanitarian file, perhaps paving the way for moving to other more complicated political files. Parallel to the Omani delegation's talks in Sana'a last week, there were persistent American attempts to push towards the legalization of the presence of foreign occupation forces in Yemeni lands and waters, and to postpone talking about this presence indefinitely, a new condition that angered Sana'a and embarrassed the Omanis. The Biden administration and Saudi Arabia attempted to limit the peace talks to confine the areas under Ansarullah's control, as the latter rejected these attempts since it completely contradicts the principles of the movement, which considers that engaging in any international endeavors that go beyond the ceiling of the Yemeni independence and sovereignty is an illegal matter. This was confirmed by the Supreme Political Council in Sana'a during its regular meeting last week, where it stressed that lifting the siege, stopping the aggression by air, land, and sea, ending the occupation, the exit of foreign forces, and non-interference in the internal affairs of Yemen are basic principles that cannot be deviated from in any future discussions.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maruf, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us. Laith, now we did see that the Omani foreign minister flew last week to Riyadh, and he had a written message from the Sultan of Oman, Sultan Haytham bin Tariq, to King Salman. And supposedly this message suggested a significant breakthrough that has been achieved concerning the Yemeni humanitarian condition. Do you think that this might be a way to pave the route for maybe going into political discussions that have been just stuck in stalemate since March 2015?
Unfortunately, I don't think so, and specifically because if you look at what the United States is attempting to do, which is to calm down as many conflicts that it's involved in and its vessels are involved in, so it can concentrate on war with China or Russia, the reality is the United States doesn't want to have peace with Iran, doesn't want to have peace with Syria or Yemen. Just like apartheid Israel doesn't want to have peace with the Palestinian people. They want to delay the confrontation, waste time on the resistance axis, pulling them into negotiations that are endless, as they did with the Palestinians for 30 years, while they concentrate on a more pressing confrontation points for them, like China and Russia. So it is in the interest of the resistance as a whole, including in Yemen, not to be pulled into this ridiculous scheme of negotiating forever.
Well, Laith, Ansarullah are still very doubtful concerning these talks, especially in the light of the continued American evasion, which recently took the form of an attempt to try and remove the issue of even talking about foreign occupation forces holding grounds inside of Yemen. They won't even, the Ansarullah not even talk about this matter. By the way, this is one of Ansarullah's big no-nos. They would never, and I mean never, accept such a condition. In that event, how do you think Saudi Arabia will react? Because we know that the Yemeni resistance will just stand its ground.
Well, look, the Saudis and the Americans behind them, as I said just before, they want to delay the confrontation, waste some time on the resistance axis. And obviously the leadership of the resistance in Yemen, Ansarullah, are smart enough after, you know, living through this war for 67 years now, and understand what is happening on the ground. Look, the apartheid Israel has taken over multiple islands on the Bab al-Mandeb strategic strait. The Emiratis are helping them colonize Socotra and other islands. This is an ongoing colonization, not even just war or occupation. It's ongoing colonization, and the only way to stop that is by defeating it militarily. And I believe the leadership in Ansarullah are smart enough to make that calculation.
Well, they did stress very much in the Supreme Political Council of Sana'a, which they meet on every week. They stressed that the lifting of the siege, the stopping of the aggression, the removal of the foreign occupation forces, also the non-interference in the internal affairs of Yemen, there are basic principles that they would not accept in any discussion. They have said that time and again. They even said that prior to the start of the war in March 2015, when then we were supposedly on the verge of having a breakthrough in the dialogue between Yemenis themselves and Mohammed bin Salman, or the power then decided to get involved in Yemen. But What are Ansarullah's options here if and when maybe these principles are not met? If Mohammed bin Salman and his American allies say, no, we won't accept it, the war continues.
The options that Ansarullah have, though, is to continue hitting the main targets, important infrastructure targets of Saudi-occupied Arabia. And in my opinion, they should expand the targeting to the United Arab Emirates because of the direct colonization of the Yemeni islands in collaboration with the apartheid Israel. And this is the only path forward. The resistance not only in Yemen but all across the region has to hit hard if the United States wants to withdraw from our region so it can concentrate on confronting China and Russia. That is actually the point, the most important moment for the resistance to hit the Americans and their vessels across the region. It is very important to recognize that even though the empire wants to withdraw, it doesn't really want to allow the resistance access to win anything. And we can see that in Palestine, for instance, and in this situation in Yemen. The vessels like Saudi-occupied Arabia are not willing to give one inch, because if they do, and this is the fear of the empire as a whole, if they give one inch to the resistance axis on any of the fronts, it will steamroll and cascade and snowball into total disaster for the empire and its vessels. So there is only an attempt to waste time and distract and delay the inevitable, which is a confrontation and an exit of the American occupying forces from the whole region.
Well, Laithi, Hadi government's position, if there is anything called the Hadi government, they are basically mercenaries, but they indicated that the Omani mediation is trying to move in a direction that does not appeal to the coalition, to the coalition aggression and the forces loyal to it on the ground in Yemen. Especially with regard to stopping the advances of Sana'a on Ma'rib governorate in the north, on the border with Saudi Arabia. Why is Ma'rib causing such a paranoia for the Saudi regime that they are ready to break any framework for a comprehensive ceasefire, at least with the Yemeni resistance?
You know, look, if we look at the battlefield, the Yemeni resistance has been pushing through the mountain regions of Najran and Jizan, the originally Yemeni provinces that were occupied by the Saudis in the 1930s, and they are gaining grounds there. So you have to imagine if the resistance in Yemen managed to liberate Ma'rib, and then that's an open, you know, flatlands all the way to Riyadh from there. So it is actually a very weak point of defense for the Saudis. And this is on top of it, the fact that there is the huge oil and gas reserves that are there that could allow Yemen to be independent in its energy needs. And we have to calculate also how Oman and why Oman is rushing right now to pressure some of the other players in the Gulf region to calm down the situation in Yemen. And it is because it's actually spilling into Oman. You know, for the last couple of weeks, there's been constant demonstrations in Oman, in the western parts that are close to Yemen, and this is a spilling situation from the fact that you know, most of these tribes in western Oman are blood relatives of people in Yemen, and you know, they can see what's happening across the region of retreat of American imperialism powers. And it's bringing back memories for the Omani authorities of the 1960s and 70s, when there was armed uprising, revolutions in Oman to dethrone the Sultan, and that is very close to the British at the time, and now is close to the Americans. So all of these are related to each other. It's one battle zone, geographic region of the world, and we have to always think about what is the interest of somebody like Oman to pressure now Saudi, and it's obvious it's connected to the troubles happening on the ground in Oman.
Definitely. It's the scene that they are going to be a very decisive couple of weeks to come for Yemen and for the region as well in the Arabian Peninsula. Thank you very much for being with us, Laith Maarouf from Beirut, political commentator, to talk about the latest developments in Yemen. Thank you, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint, a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and my dear guests, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Assalamu alaikum, Sayyid Abdullah, and
wa
welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having us.
Welcome. Brother Hussein, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum assalam, happy to be here.
Welcome. Well, let's focus on the movie in this episode, the movie called God Send. It was released in 2004, directed by Nick Hamm. All right? In this movie, a couple lose their young son in a car accident, right? They are approached by a fertilizing doctor, who happens to be Robert De Niro in the movie, of course. Mm-hmm. Who claims to be able to clone their son only on condition that, start over their life and live elsewhere, not in the same town. The clone, though, when they agreed, so the clone proves to be identical to the deceased boy. But when he reaches his 8th birthday, things begin to go wrong very horribly. Of course, I'm not going to like spoil the whole thing for those people who didn't watch the movie. Of course, it's an old movie, fairly old movie. Mm-hmm. So for those people who want to watch it, they better do. I'm not going to like kill their joy. So let me start with you, Sayyid Abdullah. How do you like the movie?
I don't know if I liked it to begin with. It was, because I don't know, sometimes like maybe I'm a little bit, maybe it's just me. When I watch a movie, I'd like to make a sense of the movie, right? Mm. Like, you know, when events happen, you attach things to one another, and like you would have one genre happening, and then, you know, you get into the movie itself.
Yes.
But the movie began okay, mm-hmm. right? So a child dies, and then a doctor trying to clone the kid, and everything seems to be fine.
Yes.
And then it turned, you know, from a just a normal cloning movie into a horror movie.
Yes.
Which, you know, I did not get. And then the father has to do his own search to find out why his son having nightmares or all these things, which to the kid were real because he can see them on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
So I think half of the movie was okay. The other half was just all over the place. And then just, I think they killed it. They just did not continue. They should have just continued the cloning process. And they would have given it a different ending rather than the one they had. Maybe it would have been a lot better. And I'm saying this from the fact that it is, the budget was 25 mil.
Yes.
And made 30 mil.
30 mil, yeah.
So it, even the box office did not make it. And we're talking about back in the day, right, where people like actually used to watch a lot of movies.
Exactly.
And it did not make
it. It wasn't the because time of COVID-19 or
exactly
something like that. They used to go to the movies.
Yeah,
like
I used to go to the movies all the time. And I'm like, you know, people were, it was just like a joyous thing that we used to do. So when, especially Robert De Niro, right, a big name in Hollywood. When he brings a movie, I don't care what kind of a movie it is. If he's in it, I'm going to watch it, right?
Yeah, but I know that's your movie book.
Yeah, but you know, the story itself just did not make it for me. I don't know. I was disappointed in Robert De Niro, to say the least.
Okay, let's take a break and we'll be back.
My clinic has perfected a procedure by which a single cell could be used to create a genetically identical fetus. A fetus which could be carried to term and, in effect, be reborn.
Do you mean cloned?
Yes. Yes.
This would be the identical boy down to the last chromosome on the last hair of his head.
So you want to help us?
I used to be affiliated with a hospital here, and I had a chance to review Jesse's records.
You did what?
I'm aware of the complications surrounding Adam's delivery. That it's impossible for you to conceive again.
You looked at her records.
I had to be certain that Jesse's condition didn't preclude carrying a child, and it doesn't. So, yes, I can help you. You can have him back.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique on RIB English Radio. Well, we're talking about God Sent, the movie released in 2004, this horror, thriller, or drama, basically, Brother Hussein. How did you like the movie? Did you find it attractive or something interesting to watch?
Actually, I'd say it was the opposite of attractive. I feel like this film is more of a like cinema movie, especially back in the day when they released it. It was more of a movie that you'd watch, you know, on a weekday night or something like that. But in general, I feel like it was a drama-driven movie.
Mm-hmm.
It had a lot of, you know, action scenes, I guess. Lots of heartfelt moments. And the thing is about this movie that it, you know, like Brother Abdullah said, it didn't really flow very well. The beginning was kind of normal, but then it kind of turns dark. And, you know, with the nightmares of the kid and, you know, all the other stuff that happens, I didn't really...
You know, when we were talking about, like, in the earlier episodes, talking about the movie The Sixth Day, you, in fact, found out that this seemed to be a kind of mismatch between reality and the movie, or what concept the movie was trying to push.
Yeah.
All right? What about this movie? Do you think that, they depicted the reality of cloning, which is the subject of our discussion, too?
So, not really sure what to say. Of course, each writer has his own predictions about the future of technology like this. So, I feel like this was also a unique perspective. And like I did say in the previous episode, it's either a hit or a miss, but only time will tell.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have in 1996 or 7, we have the phenomenon of Dolly the Sheep, all right? And then there is a claim in around 2000, if I'm not mistaken, in South Korea of talking about cloning a human being, all right, for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But it proved to be wrong. They didn't show any evidence. Nor did they do the same thing in 2004, which is concurrent with the time of release of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
2004, again, there was another rumor in South Korea at one of the universities that they basically cloned a human being. But again, there was no scientific evidence whatsoever released to the media or to the critics and skeptics of the time.
It was two articles were written by two different scientists, like you mentioned, and I think Science, the organization, they withdrew these two articles because they said there's absolutely no proof of it. And as the process itself
exactly
complicated, they said they just
even with Dolly the Sheep, 276 attempts failed.
Exactly, yeah.
And then 277th attempt succeeded. And led to the Dolly, which lived a few years after. Six months.
That doesn't 6 months.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
All right. So do you think, Brother Hussein, there is a kind of, what do you call it, a coincidence?
With what exactly?
With the time?
I feel like, especially with university students or, you know, young people, they sort of, you know, are hyped up by these movies or by these events, and they try to, you know, sometimes even lie about stuff like this happening. Like you said, there was no evidence found with these people, with their claims, so it was dismissed.
I see. Yep. Okay, let's take a break and we'll be back.
Cells are in essence clones, identical copies of one original cell. Now, key to artificially stimulating replication is in shocking a specialized cell back to its pre-specialized state, its stem cell precursor, the cell as it was before it became a liver cell or a brain cell or a relatively simpler cheek cell. Once in this state, the cell's nucleus is immediately transferred to a mother's enucleated egg. The transfer completed, the egg cell will then ideally accept the donor nucleus as its own, at which point we let nature take its course.
Back to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio. We are talking about the critique of the movie Godsend, a 2004 drama movie. The most important or famous star in the movie is Robert De Niro. Sayyid Abdullah, there are things, in fact, like portrayed in this movie related to the idea of cloning. Like when this son, the clone, reaches the eighth birthday, he starts having like nightmares or something like that, or visions. It came to be even in reality, like happening in reality. Do you think that those like nightmares could exist, like for real? Clones?
Okay, so first we have to come to the agreement that we already had successfully cloned a human being.
Yes.
Then we come to your question. I think from the question that you asked the Brother Hussein before, where the, you know, the cloning process was better, at least it done a lot well than the sixth day, right? Because it went through the pre-productive cloning system where they take the embryo and they plant it in a womb and then you have a child, which is scientifically, even scientifically, that's what they're hoping to achieve. Like you said, with Dolly, it took 100-something attempts.
Yes,
with a human being, it might take, I don't know, more than that. And but they might need like different, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred wombs for it to work. But this is a pre-productive system, so it's done a lot better in the cloning process than the sixth day, right? So this could be digested, could be swallowed, because it could be scientifically later on could work.
Yeah.
But that itself, it's not going to give you a clone. It's going to give you an identical twin, right? So we call it a twin.
Yes.
So it's going to give you a human being that looks like the old one, the predecessor, but it would have he would have his own personality. He would have his own soul. He would not be the same exact person. The outside might be, but not the inside. In this movie, though, they were assuming that up to 8 years, he was identical from outside and inside. So he was doing very well. Once he hits eight, because the child dies at eight, and even Robert De Niro in the movie is like, well, we don't know what's going to happen after eight.
Because
he... It's a plane. So then that thing, you know, he started having his own imaginary things. So what they're trying to say is that the personality of the other child would try to conflict with the child himself, where in fact what Rob Minier did, he inserted his own son's genes,
yes,
in that child.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's very complicated in a sense, like if we need to, you know, dissect the movie itself, because we don't even have, not only do we have a clone,
mm-hmm,
as a body, but we have two personalities in that clone.
Yes.
We have De Niro's son, and we have that child himself.
Right.
And then that De Niro's son, his personality is trying to take over the body itself and be the active host.
Yes.
Which, that's where you have the whole horror theme to it.
No.
So,
you know, is it logically possible for, like, somebody to experience the same, like, mentalities, the same feelings and emotions?
Well, if we're talking scientifically,
Or logically,
right? Leave logic aside, because sometimes logic cannot process things, right?
Uh-huh,
cannot fathom.
Okay.
Scientifically, they've proven, like, I don't know, years back, that some traits get transferred through DNA. So, for example, some of my father's traits get transferred to me. For example, if my father was generous, that trait of generosity I could carry that. That it transferred to my gene.
Generosity
so
is different from like the same type of like happening or experience.
No, so
in another real life.
So this is what I'm trying to get.
Externally.
This is what I'm trying to get. So if we're saying scientifically it's possible,
mm-hmm,
for certain traits to be transferred, there's also a possibility that you might have memories or feelings that a person had,
mm-hmm,
could be transferred to you. So scientifically, maybe in the future they could prove that, because the DNA itself is a very complex thing, right?
True.
It could carry many things.
Yes.
We just recently managed to break the DNA code, right? We don't know what's in the code itself.
Yes.
So maybe the code itself, it could not only carry the trace, but it could carry memories with it,
mm-hmm,
that you might experience yourself. So you could have a dream, you could have a vision of something that already been seen in the past. It's possible, like scientifically possible. Ethically, I don't see why not.
Yeah,
but would it take over you? I doubt.
Yeah, I have some serious issues with that.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the time of this episode has come to an end. Let me put it off to the next upcoming episode.
Inshallah.
Thank you very much for listening to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio. We were talking about Godsend. And we covered some issues, but hopefully we're going to continue this episode into the next one. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam once said, "If the eye is bathed in tears, Allah will protect its owner from the fire. If the tear flows down the cheek, neither miserliness nor abasement will befall its owner. There is a punishment for everything except the tear, for Allah the Most High forgives the seas of sins through it."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the dialogues and the conversations of the fifth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, that he talks with his companions about social etiquettes. He talks with his companions about how to treat people in the best and most perfect manner, how to treat people according to the laws and the prescriptions of Islam, which have been gifted to humanity by Allah in order to create a perfect society, a utopian society, a society which has no blemishes and has been the goal and the mission of mankind right from the beginning. And I will very humbly say that humanity has not attained that utopian society, and humanity will never attain that utopian society until and unless they implement and inculcate the prescriptions that have been prescribed by Allah. Humanity can try all they can, they will never reach perfection if they do not follow the rules and the commands and the prescriptions given to the one who is the most perfect, the ultimate perfection, Allah. Imam al-Baqir talks in this conversation, in this dialogue with his companion, about some qualities of the Shia, the true followers of Islam, the true followers of the Holy Prophet. Imam al-Baqir says to his companion that these people, the true followers of Islam, the Shia, they perform the prayers and the fasting. So first and foremost, from among all the things, we must be able to keep up our prayers and we must keep up our fasting. Then Imam al-Baqir says that they are truthful in talking. Dear friends, we must always speak the truth. We must always tell the truth. We must not lie. We must not cheat. We must not deceive. We must not gossip. We must not backbite. We must not use obscene language. Be truthful in your talking. Be sincere in your talking. Be honest in your talking. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that you should be so bluntly truthful, so frankly truthful that you hurt good people's feelings. I mean, use some common sense as well, but be truthful in your speaking. And finally, they recite the Quran. One of the things in which truly we are weak is the recitation of the Holy Quran, and furthermore, the contemplation upon the verses of the Holy Quran. Dear friends, the reciting the Quran is one of the forms of spiritual refinement, spiritual progress, spiritual perfection, spiritual purification, the recitation and the contemplation upon the Holy Quran, the very word of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. Beautiful words brought to us in this dialogue by Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
The Quran is not clear what it's referring to, who the role models are, what the stories are. Fabricated ahadith have been given to distract people from the actual messages of the Quran. There's one of the stories, Musa and someone that he learned from. The Quran says, Abdan min ibadina. There's plenty of great lessons there. Now, a person who has presented himself as a scholar, and he was a Jewish scholar, now pretended to be a Muslim, is now sharing loads of baloney about what the Quran says. He's introduced all this stuff. His name is Khidr, and they call him Khidr for this reason. He did this, he did that. A whole distraction. When you get to the story of Khidr, or the story of Musa and this person, even someone who wants to look at the Quran and understand from it, the first thing that comes to their mind, Khidr, and all the things you have heard about Khidr. Is he alive? Is he not alive? And so on and so forth. Get to the story of the Quran. Who cares if he's alive or he isn't? The Quran has teachings there. The Quran is available, but the teachings are not clear because of everybody's saying different things about it. The words of the Prophet, enough of them are not available. Here and there, yes, some ahadith are there. But it's not enough to form a world view for you that you would be able to clearly understand everything else in light of that. It's bits and pieces. The methodology that Imam al-Baqir presented to the Muslim Ummah that affected and influenced and was able to preserve and bring closer to the track and tracks of the Holy Prophet, what he laid down as the tracks for believers, the path, the true path, Sirat al-Mustaqim, this methodology was something that brought everyone closer to that path.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we are here with you with another episode of From the Moon to the Sun. And at this point of the show, we are getting closer and closer to one of the most joyous and celebratory occasions in the Islamic calendar. It is the anniversary of the dawn of the eighth sun of the sky of Wilaya, and it is the day that the hearts of the devotees of the Ahlul Bayt rejoice in the glory that is the birthday of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. Imam Ridha, too, I think every Shia person in the world is nothing short of a king, a sultan, a lord, a master, someone whose shrine is a sanctuary, a safe haven for all of our souls. And I pray with all sincerity that whoever whose heart is yearning and longing to visit the glorious shrine of Imam Ridha, by the right of Imam Ridha and by the right of his beloved sister Sayyidina Masuma Salamullah Alayha, may Mashhad be your destination in the very near future. We're here with my special sister and beloved friend, Sister Razia Shamali. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, my dear sister. You took my heart to the city of Mashhad.
I know, I've got goosebumps. Yeah. All of a sudden, I felt my heart just separating from my body for a moment.
Yeah, me too.
Inshallah,
I
soon.
I pictured myself in the shrine of Ali ibn Musa Ridha for some moment.
Exactly.
Inshallah, very soon we would go together.
Inshallah, that would be awesome. So, Eid Mubarak once more. I just love this 10-day period between the two birthdays.
Yeah,
I go around and tell everyone
Eid Mubarak
because...
Yeah.
If we're ever going to have any sort of happiness in life, may it be the happiness of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam.
I would also like to express my congratulations to all our dear audience on the birthday anniversaries of Ali bin Musa Ridha al-Murtada,
Sayyidina Masuma,
salamullah alayha, and also the day that we commemorate the memory of the holy and noble personality of Ahmad bin Musa, the brother of Sayyidina Masuma and Imam Musa.
Imam Ridha alayhi salam. So congratulations to all the Shias of Ahlul Bayt, and of course to our beloved Imam Zaman. Soon, someday, I don't know when, but someday we will celebrate the Eid of his reappearance, inshallah.
Inshallah, we would be there to experience having an Imam by our side.
Inshallah. So there's so much we can talk about Imam Ridha alayhi salam, the son of Imam Musa al-Kadhim. And I don't think five episodes is even close to being enough, but we're going to try. So let's begin.
Okay. Imam Ridha is actually my favorite Imam among, I mean, I love all of them, but I have a very close connection, heart connection with him, because I was born on the eve of the birthday of Imam Ridha. So I look at him as my spiritual father. There's so much to say. First of all, just to give some historical information about his birthday, he was born on the 11th of Dhul Qa'dah in the year 148 after Hijra. For 31 years, he was under the direct guidance and guidance of his blessed father, Imam Musa Ridha.
Imam Musa
al-Kadhim. Sorry, I've been saying these names so many times,
yeah.
I've mixed them. And he was born 1 month after the martyrdom of Imam As-Sadiq. Did you know that?
No.
I was very, as I was going through these historical information, it was very interesting that... he was concurrent with his father for 35 years. And there is so much to say about the ethical virtues, about the akhlaq of Ali bin Musa Ridha. I can say people, there are so many narrations, depicting and describing the features of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. For example, in one of them, you read that Imam Ridha never used a harsh language or harsh voice to talk to people. He was very gentle in talking. He was very polite. He never stretched his legs in front of other people. He never laughed, just like the noble prophet that you never heard him laughing at, like, he only smiled very gently and like a gentleman, very
subtle,
mildly.
Right.
Whenever someone came to him to ask, like, if they had a request and he was able to grant them, he would never refuse. He was very, very generous with his servants. And he would say that if I come to you, because usually they would raise up, they would stand up to show their respect and esteem to their master. He said that if you're eating something and I come to you, remain seated until you finish eating. I don't want you to show me respect. You know, respect yourself, respect your food, have your food, and then you can show me respect. And even his servants would say that, no, it's a big deal how he treated the people who were working for him. Because I was picturing for myself, I was picturing a very high and lofty manager who has a lot of workers who are working under him. And when he enters some place, they all have to show their respect. When
right.
he calls them, they have to rush to him. We're talking about like 1,200 years ago. And, you know, in that time, all these were something
very different.
Very different.
Inshallah, more of that after a short break. Ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is From the Moon to the Sun. We're here with Sister Razi Shamilin. We're commemorating the birth anniversary of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. We're getting very close, final countdowns to the auspicious occasion. And we've been talking about the ethical merits and virtues of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. And you were talking about how you imagined the scenario where he is this manager, this big boss, and he has like many, many people under his supervision. And like when you think about it, that's how big bosses are. Like when they walk into the office, everyone suddenly stands up, or if they're like doing something irrelevant, they'll put it aside and
exactly.
they'll show respect. And how was the atmosphere in Imam Ridha's house though?
Imam Ridha even told his servants that if I call you to do something and if you're eating something, do not get interrupted. Continue eating, and then don't come to me, don't rush to me. So what is it, my master? Go on eating, do whatever you want to do. And then once you're finished, come and, you know, have my request or my orders answered. This is very interesting. I when I pictured it with myself, I was really, I was so excited
so touched,
and moved
yeah.
by it. Right? And it's very interesting that the Imam never ate food alone. As
really?
If, yeah, he, whenever he wanted to have...
table
was spread to have food, he called everyone, the guest, the servants, the doorman, everyone came and sat with the Imam and they all dined together. They all had food together. This shows the humility of Imam Musa Ridha.
Absolutely. And when you have such a master, I think everyone would want to be his servant.
Right.
So beautiful.
So beautiful. Sometimes some people would tell him that, you know, your forefathers, your grandfather, your father were all very noble people. And he would say that, no, I'm not proud of just merely being, you know, the son of such and such a man. My proudness is being the father, being the son and the grandson and the, you know, grandsons of people who were God-fearing, who were pious, who were really muttaqi in the true sense of the word. And only this is the key point that would make me to be very proud of my forefathers. This is exactly, this goes back to the verse in the Noble Quran that says, Ya ayyuhan nas, inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin wa untha, wa ja'alnakum qaba'ish uban wa qaba'ilan lata'arafu, inna akramakum indallahi atqakum. In so many different ahadith that I was, in the narrations that I was reading regarding the noble personality of Imam Ali ibn Musa Ridha, this was very highlighted, that in, even in the case that he was dining and he was having food with all the servants and the gatekeepers, and people, once someone who was very fond of royal etiquette, he said, no, don't you think it's a better idea if you have a separate arrangements for your servants so that they would have to eat separately and you as the master to eat differently in a separate place? He said that no, we are all created by the same creator, and our mother is Eve. We are born from the same mother Eve and from the same father Adam. And we will be counted on the day of judgment only based upon our deeds. And so there is no different, no reason that I have to discriminate or segregate my staff and, you know, with myself. So this was highlighted in many instances in the life of Imam Ali ibn Musa Ridha. Well, he tried to stress, not once, but many times, that inna akramakum indallahi atqakum. This is so beautiful.
It really is. And I think the greatest testament for the for this matter is how after 1,200 years, Imam Ridha alayhi salam is known worldwide as the Sultan. And that...
Imam Ra'ul.
Exactly. And that it's so interesting the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala decides to give izzah, to give honor to someone, like 1,200 years after the death of a man, like his physical body is no longer here,
right,
yet millions of people flock from all regions, all corners of the world to be his servants. And
really,
I think that
really
is the most magical thing in the world. Thank you so much,
thank
Sister Razia.
Just one point. In the khuddam, in the servants who are serving him in his shrine, there are people from different walks of life, specifically from the upper walks of life. Like, there are so many doctors, professors, people who are like really
elites
in the society, and they would just would beg the shrine Astan Qutsa Radhavi just to be the servants of Imam for one day, to work in the shuket, you know,
right,
the shoe room where they keep the shoes.
SubhanAllah.
So it shows the honor. It shows that if you're really a muttaqi person, Allah will elevate your status to a point that you will be the Shams al-Shumus.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And
thank you
to our audience for being with us. We're getting very close to the birth anniversary of Imam Ridha. And here on the moon to the sun, we wish you happy Eid. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Today we would like to introduce to you a book that deals with a very important subject. We as human beings require a method a means, a way in which to get to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, a guide or a lamp. And one of the most important means by which we get to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is by our own actions and behaviors, our ethics and our akhlaq. Therefore, the book that we would like to introduce to our dear brothers and sisters today deals with that. And the title, you know, is a very beautiful title. The title is As-Siraj. Siraj means that lamp or that kind of, it's an oil lamp rather, that guides you, as we see in old movies, you know, a